We're back now with John Clark, and we have been discussing his great-grandfather's journal. John, when we left, we had set up the environment. So what happens next? The journey begins.
Okay. All right, yeah, the journey begins. Michael, I think that what is going through their minds, because this was a hard decision for these two guys to make, but with what was going on in their lives in terms of the country and locally for them, there needed to be a time for change. And so here, the first page of this journal, and you know, it's interesting. People may wonder, was this guy, and you kind of mentioned it, was this guy writing for himself, or was he writing for his family, or who was he writing for? Well, you know, there was no TV, and radio wasn't really that strong at this particular point in time. You know, people wrote and read a lot. If you get into this book, you'll see where he refers to Shakespeare, he refers to Homer. He took books with him. And everybody was reading. McClure's Magazine was a great periodical that was started in the 1890s and had great articles by wonderful writers from all over the country that were good writers, you know, that were not just the dime novel kind of people. They were intelligent, well-educated people that Sam McClure hired to put but everybody wanted a McClure's Magazine. You know, Harper's was another one, but McClure's was the big deal because that's where they got a lot of their news and got a lot of their feelings about what was going on in politics, where all the scientific inventions. It was so everybody was kind of in that mood of, I mean, they were reading and they were writing. These guys wrote tons of letters home, and they would go for months without receiving any. And their families would go months without receiving any once they were up in Alaska. So you have to understand that the printed word and the written word were extremely important to people during this period. So anyway, let me get started with reading this first entry. February 17, 1898. Left home this day for Alaska, 4:35 p.m. Have thought before that I had endured many hardships, many hard things in this life, but never came across anything like parting from my family. I walked to school with my boys to say goodbye out of sight of my wife. I could plainly see their little forms as they passed out of sight into the schoolhouse. The only thought that keeps me up is that I am going for the good of them and their darling mother. And if parting from my boys was hard, that from my wife was torture. I had known for days that it would be difficult. But the sad look in those eyes I can never forget as she said, I know I shall never see you again. But she shall, and I will come back to her and the boys and prepare to take care of them as they deserve. Oh, there are things in this life, too sacred to speak about. And one is the love of a good wife. I left the house with dire forebodings, but somehow, since the train has pulled out, I've gained confidence and especially determination to go forward and make one great effort to place my family on the plane to which they belong. That's how this journal starts out. And there are pieces of this all the way through it. Go ahead.
Yes. You know, it didn't take me long to begin to form an opinion, to paint a picture of this man that was writing in this journal. And it immediately struck me the depth of feeling and that he had for his family and how tortured he was in making the decision to leave.
Yeah.
Now,
it's interesting how this applies to just about anybody, even our top leadership in this world. I mean, there are leadership teachings here in terms of, you know, family first, you know, focusing, and sometimes you have to set your family aside to focus on something that's going to put them on the plane that you want them to be on. And it's a hard balance for everybody in this world, especially someone that did not, you know, was not a wealthy person. We have one chapter in here, and actually not a chapter, it's the the prologue to this that was written by my friend Doug Keeney, which is really very good. And we kind of entitled the prologue that he had "An Uncommon Entrepreneur." There is some business teaching here in terms of leadership, how you handle people, how you organize people, how you have to discipline yourself when there's a lot of things that tempt you in this world. And having the responsibility of taking other people's money and going in on an adventure like this is pretty pretty exciting and pretty scary and for anybody. So, I mean, I just... it's just a note there that I thought I'd.
He was quite a salesman too, apparently.
Oh yeah, he had to be a salesman. That was interesting. And there's a wonderful dialogue, there's the difference between these two men. These two men, his partner Andrew Jackson Meals, was a cowboy. He was a bull whacker. He was a stagecoach driver. He was a farmer, rancher. He drove cattle. He was the kind of the rowdy Yates. That's kind of the way I think of him every time I think about that man. But he was not a well-educated man. He was but he was a doer. He had a genius for mathematics. He became a surveyor and a road builder while he was in Alaska. And George Cheever Hazel was he was a politician. He wore suits. He went to Washington. He lobbied for a lot of things. It was a great partnership in that regard, because where Hazlett kind of found the money or put the deal together, Andrew Jackson Meals would execute or gather the information. He's a great surveyor. He sent him out on all sorts of expeditions, and that's in this book. It's really interesting how they got together, and they were a perfect fit, and they were partners for lifelong. And they died within a couple of years of each other. You know, it's kind of like a marriage.
Oh, well, and you make a point about leadership lessons in there. I hadn't given that a lot of thought. It had cropped up, obviously, because of the leadership role that your great grandfather.
Well, to put a company together. I mean, that's what they did. I mean, they hired the second time they went up, they had about 25 people, and they brought up. Hydraulics, was an innovative way.
Right. I mean, what it brings to mind is, yes, you know, it's okay. For example, it's okay to work on your weaknesses, but not at the expense of your strengths. So,
right.
Your great grandfather did what he does well, and focused on that. Brought on people that did the other things that were indispensable that needed doing that they did well. And folks are allowed to do that. You know, some good things can happen.
Absolutely.
So,
and
so
that's teamwork, working as a team. I mean, he mentions this. There are so many groups of people that went up there that that were ill prepared. I mean, they did not know how to survive in the wilderness. I mean, you're talking about, 70 below 0 degree weather during the winter sometimes, and having to
cannot imagine those
across the lake. Yeah, I mean, there's Gore-Tex was not invented yet, and they all you could do is just layer up, and I can't imagine what the boots were like. I mean, they're just leather soled boots.
Would have been brutal. It's brutally challenging to I can't imagine.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, here let me get into a couple more pieces and see how we go. But the Sea Journey,
yes.
I mean, they all met up in Seattle. You know, they're hanging around up there, outfitting themselves. And then they finally get on their boat. Here's a short passage here, or a couple paragraphs here. "We expect now to get off by 2 p.m. The shrill whistle of the boss freight loader and the hum of voices is all that serves to break the monotony at present, except that. Be the barking of the poor dogs that seem to be taking this method of protesting against going to the frozen north. 2:40 p.m. and we are just pulling out. There must be at least 1,000 people on the wharf, cheering, waving hats, handkerchiefs, anything that they have. The boat's whistle is blowing, shrill blast, and we are off for the frozen north. Some of us never to return, others to meet some sort of success, no doubt, but more doomed to disappointment. Which," he asks his question, "which class do we belong to? This was all new to me. Strange are the sights and sounds, stranger the feelings that surge through my breast. 6 p.m. and supper is ready, and what a sight. 200 men of all nationalities almost crowded into the hole. Two long tables swinging from the ceiling will only hold about one-fifth of those that have to eat. We are told by the steward that there will be 5 tables, and we are on deck, and we go on deck to wait for the last call. In the meantime, to sit among the dogs, smoke our pipes, and talk about the prospects for the future. At about 7:45, we go down, find the dishes, of course, all of 10. I guess he was expecting China. And filthy and dirty, they were filthy and dirty as if hogs had been fed from them. But we must eat something. Hence, we arrange ourselves along the table, being thankful that we even get a chance to stand alongside it. The man in charge dishes up some sort of combination, which he calls Irish stew, but much resembles swill. This we eat, then we are helped to a cold potato, boiled, some bread that is not too bad, and a large cup of black tea. We stow away some of this frugal meal and again go on deck to smoke and dream dreams of gold. At 9 p.m., I go below to fix my bunk and get some sleep. I'm thankful that no dirty cook has anything to do with sleep. So, I can read a little more. You want me to read a little more? I can do that. This stuff like this is all the way through this book. The guy was a writer. Of course, he was a school teacher. But he had a lot of heart, feeling.
Yes. Well, that was the other beautiful thing, though. I mean, the gem of a journal that this is, you know, it's not a series of diary entries.
No.
You know, by
good
any
point.
Stretch of the imagination.
Good point.
It is, while not written for a particular audience other than himself, he holds himself to a pretty high standard in regard to the grammar. There's a flow to it. You can actually hear him. You know, you can hear his character speaking those words. I mean, it's to the point where there's a natural cadence. I mean, it's just, I can't go on enough about it. It's excellent. I feel so fortunate that it was presented to me to read, because it took me to such a different place and inside the mind of a pretty spectacular individual. You know.
Yeah, but you know, there are people like that today. But it was just, we just had different technology, different things. But there are people going on like you know, there are people. But this is just a common guy that is trying to make something happen, and that's what's cool about this. I think this is not Teddy Roosevelt that had all the privileges that anybody could want. He was a rich man, but he was an interesting individual. Definitely learned. And that's why some say that the new Republican Party, because there was a reform going on at this particular time in terms of the conservative thinking and the reformist thinking in terms of keeping listening to the common man and making sure that the common man is brought along with the rest of us that might have made a lot of money. And that took a rich man to be able to say that, because nobody was going to push him out of the way and say that he had no voice. But he had to be sensitive enough to understand. And Roosevelt was a wonderful person in that regard. Now, he had some other issues, but that one piece of him made him one of our great American presidents. You know, I mean, that's where I guess some people might not think so, but he's at least on the mountaintop. You know, over there, they carved a picture of him along with some other pretty great guys. Now, let me just read one more thing. This is March 17th entry. They're in Valdez, Alaska, which was nothing but a tent city, and they have gone up over the Valdez Glacier for the first. This is the first time. Well, now I have learned what it is to make an ass of myself in earnest. One way, at least, is to harness yourself up to a 6-foot sled, put 200 pounds on it, and strike the trail for the foot of the glacier, which is 5 miles away. Repeat this twice a day for a week, and you soon have long ears, but it is almost all there at this writing. And now our real work begins. And that's what he meant when he said it's almost all there. It's kind of, remember, he's writing in incredible conditions, but that means that all their goods had been by sled, by 200-pound sleds, had been brought up. A year's supply of goods had been brought 5 miles just to the foot of the glacier before they even get to go up over it. And they did this, I don't know how many, it took a couple of weeks to do that, I guess.
Well, I was in awe of the physical prowess that either he already possessed, or apparently he did, because they hit the ground running, or definitely had to acquire up there.
But they were very organized. There's something incredible about how these two guys organized. They've never been to Alaska, and they'd never been to Seattle, for that matter. But they had certain skills that they had learned from their fathers and from being in the Midwest. We will, in the next 2 weeks, have to reach the summit. In order to do this, we have to cross at least 12 miles of rough, rugged glacier, now covered with snow. From foot to the summit, it rises at least 2,000 feet. The trail crosses wide cracks and crevices, which are perhaps hundreds of feet deep. Scattered all over it are large boulders weighing thousands of tons, waiting for the sun to melt the ice and snow and allow them to tumble down to the sea. A glacier is treacherous. It lies quietly waiting for its victims with yawning cracks filled with loose snow. Once you fall into one of those cracks without help near, and you have gone the way of all the earth, one might think they would remain forever in cold storage. But not so, for the treacherous thing is slightly moving onto the sea. And while it might be years, yet in the course of time, he would find that his bones would be mingling with the sands of the sea. I mean, there's a... There's poetry.
Very humbling thought. Yeah, well, but also he's recognizing it's hitting him full in the face, the awesomeness, the sheer power of nature. And I guess also you couldn't help but, I'm sure, because he referenced the beauty and the splendor and just how insignificant, I believe there's a reference in there, man was made to feel in the presence.
It was awesome. He was awestruck by the landscape. And if anybody ever gets up to Valdez, I've been up there several times, of course. It is the mountain. It's like going into the Swiss Alps. I mean, it is the mountains come right to the sea, and Valdez Bay is just tucked right in there. It's just an incredible sight. There's snow on the mountains even during the summertime.
I cannot get over. Just the sheer physical fortitude. I mean, everything is done manually. All the big things are still done manually, and by right. you, and you're trying not to freeze to death, survive, hopefully, encounters with, grizzly bears and whatever else might be running up around up there, and
patience,
not trying to drown.
Patience is a virtue up there. And you have to be smart, or you have to be calculating about every movement, or else you're going to fall into a crack, have some sort of incident that you can't get out of. It's a survival mode that you need to be well aware of your surroundings, and especially if you knew nothing about the surroundings. They went into a country where very few white men had ever been before. There's two more pieces here that I'm going to read, and this is not written by my grandfather, but this is an old newspaper dated April 1st, 1898. It's called the Klondike News. This was a tabloid kind of thing that was floating around up there. This is April 1st. Remember, they had already been up there a few months. They had come in February of 1898. So whether to go, there's two articles, whether to go and how to go. Whether to go, the man who is still debating with himself to the advisability of going to the Yukon is still very much in evidence. He is still undecided as to whether he can stand the cold and endure the hardships of the trip, and also as whether he can make anything if he does get there. We would advise all such to stay home They are not the stuff that pioneers are made of. He is much in the same fix as the young man who thinks he is in love but is not quite sure, who has doubts as to the advisability of getting married, as well as to his ability to support her if she says yes. Our advice to that young man would be, don't. If we were really in love, there would be no room for doubt in his own mind on the subject. And the only question that would present itself would be, will she have me? The man who will take a success in the northern mines has no fear of cold dangers, nor of his own ability to succeed. And the only question he asks himself is, can I get there? Pretty much of an entrepreneurial spirit here. Any young man in good faith who is without family ties, who has no prospects in life other than a steady job and a living, is very foolish if he does not take a rough and tumble chance up north for a few years. It will broaden his mind, harden his muscles, improve his health, and possibly gain him a fortune. And even though he returns to civilization, there's a big question mark here, at the expiration of 2 or 3 years without a dollar, he will be better off than the man who remained at home and did not save a dollar. This, of course, applies only to those who can land upon the river with a year's provisions. There are many that went up there with none. Jack London,
that's great.
He was a mess. He went up there with nothing. He was a poor man. But he ended up going over the Chilkoot Pass, and wonderful stories of what he experienced. There's a wonderful biography of him that I read recently. I don't have that book here in front of me. I can't tell you the name of it. But he was stomping around up here at the same time.
Oh wow! He talks about
all the. You know, the issues that he had over on Chilkoot Pass were all these people that did not know what they were doing over there. And there are lines of people lining up like a black snake. And I think George Cheever Hazlett says that about the Valdez Glacier. You know, there were 10,000 people that ended up there, and they were snaking their way up over that glacier, very much like what you see in the Chilkoot Pass area. It's incredible. Here's how to go. This is telling. We warn our readers against any attempt to reach the Klondike by way of Copper River. Of course, Copper River is the way these guys went. No living man ever made the trip, and the bones of many a prospector whitened the way. In the first place, it is almost impossible to ascend the Copper River. There are trackless mountains to cross, by the side of which the Chilkoot Pass Trail is a boulevard, and rapids that would make the White Horse dry up and quit business. Finally, the White River is not navigable for loaded boats. Certain unscrupulous parties operating steamboats up that way are issuing gaudy pamphlets with nicely worded directions of how to travel over a country that white men never has set foot in. This is worse than murder, and such crimes deserve to be punished to the full extent of the law. We would suggest that they be hung, drawn, quartered, and fed to a pack of hungry Malamute dogs. Now this, I can imagine, this is a Klondike News, April 1st, George Cheever Hazlett and his party, Andrew Jackson Mills and other folks sitting around a campfire up on the Copper River saying, what the hell are we doing up here? they're telling everybody that they were crazy to be here. That's part of the reason he went through the Copper River Valley. Everybody was going up over the Chilkoot Pass. I mean, if there were 10,000 people in Valdez going up over the Valdez Glacier into the Copper River country, there were 4 or 5 times that many people over there at Chilkoot Pass, which is
he definitely took the long view. And I'm sorry, but we're beginning to run short on time.
That gives everybody kind of a flavor of what this book's about.
It's a great flavor. It's a great read. I highly recommend it. Hazlett's Journal by George Cheever Hazlett, published by his great-grandson, John Clark. Before we let you go, John, how do our listeners find Hazlett's Journal? How do they purchase it? And how do they learn more about Old Stone Press, your author services company?
Yeah, there's a couple of ways to do that. Hazlett's Journal, you can go to hazlettsjournal.com, H-A-Z-E-L-E-T-S, journal, J-O-U-R-N-A-L.com. And you can go, there's a website there. You can even find us on Facebook if you go there, because I post excerpts of this book up on Facebook, so you can find us that way too. The Old Stone Press is oldstonepress.com. You can get to the site from both these sites from either one of them. So if you got to Hazlett's Journal, you could click on Old Stone Press and kind of get over and see what the other books that we publish. And there is going to be a sequel to this Hazlett's Journal. I've got an interesting thing I'm working on now, which will talk about the rest of this man's life. He eventually, of course, does not meet J.P. Morgan, but he works for him and the Guggenheim brothers, and they form what is called the Alaska Syndicate, which built railroads and built the famous Kennecott copper mines in McCarthy, Alaska.
Well, can't wait to hear that.
Story. That's an interesting story. Okay, great.
Yeah, really can't wait to hear that one. But just real quick, I don't want to get away without having you mention this also, because I think it's really important for our authors and prospective authors out there, a little bit about the unique services that Old Stone Press provides.
Old Stone Press is an author services company. We are a partnership publishing company. We partner with authors. We help authors that do not want to take care of the detail of self-publishing themselves, basically. They don't want to hire the printer or the graphic designer or the copy editor. They not want someone to manage that project for them. We help authors that all they want to do is create. They want to write, and they need a partner to help them go to market with their book or get it published. And that's pretty much what Old Stone Press does. And that's evolved a lot because of Hazlett's Journal, but I've done a couple of books before that, but I never formed a company to do it. And after I sold my commercial printing and binding business, I went to work studying on how to build a publishing company around the self-publishing phenomenon that's out there. And really kind of I knew that there are people out there that did not want to take care of that detail, but they wanted a partner in terms of putting their book together and going to market with it.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you, John. I'm afraid we are out of time. I really appreciate you taking the time once again to join us on the show. You get a chance,
all right,
folks, check out Hazlett's Journal and check out the other works available and coming available from Old Stone Press.